Anyway, right, focus on form. Doesn't seem very important. But anyway, let's go on. What I'd just like to, I think it's been really interesting, the forum discussion. And maybe we can just pick up on some of the points that have been made on the forum first, because I want to just try to curb the idea that focus on form is mainly or only about recasts, because maybe my presentation was a bit misleading in some points. Long himself favors recasts, a kind of privileged way of delivering focus on form, but I think we have to pull back a little bit and recognize that it's definitely not the only way, and in a lot of cases it might not be the appropriate way, and that there are more explicit things that could happen in a classroom that still work within a TBLT framework and count as focus on form rather than focus on forms. So just a comment that I think the really key thing for long, at least, is that it's reactive and it takes place within communicative activity. And then it could be so many different things. It could be, he mentions consciousness raising, it could be explicit connection with a rule, it could be this more natural recast that we talked about as well. But is that clear to everybody? Yeah, that it is this huge range of pedagogic procedures. Yeah. And that he tries not to be very prescriptive about it. I just think because he's been defending recasts for a number of years, and we mentioned this book on the forum, the 2007 book, that I'll try to get a copy of that chapter because it's really interesting, where he defends recasts from a number of criticisms, and he also presents a lot of evidence from different studies to show that it's effective. Now, it might not be immediately effective, and there are a number of like caveats, right? So I think the first thing is what we're going to look at or discuss as we go on today is simply, is the student ready for that particular form? Can they progress to that, or is it going to be something that comes a lot later? So Anita, you mentioned, yeah, we can do a lot of recasting, etc., but we don't get evidence that students are picking up on it. And then maybe it seems like a waste of time, or it seems like it's not being noticed. And it just could be that the students are not ready to notice it or not ready to kind of take it on board. So that's one factor, right? The second factor that I just mentioned in a post a little short while ago is just this issue of saliency. And the less salient it is, then possibly the more explicit we need to be in our correction, and that a recast just might not be noticed. And that's kind of why I think, and I didn't probably explain it properly in the presentation, but the example you mentioned, both of you, John and Stephen, that I'd called a recast when Alan had said, what was it again? It was a preposition mistake, right?
Working on it and working in it.
Yes. I think if he just said, so you're working on it, in that more natural way. So she said, yes, we're working on it. And she said, we're working in it. If he'd said, okay, great, so you're working on it, good, I think probably then it doesn't get noticed. So it's a kind of, let's say, it's. I still think it's a recast, but it's a recast where the teacher's chosen to use stress to really highlight the preposition, and you can see immediate uptake. And I think that's perfectly well justified. That is a good example of something that's just not salient. It's not stressed. It's a preposition, it doesn't stick out. And I don't know about the learners that you guys work with, but certainly Spanish and Catalan learners have a lot of trouble with the distinction between in and on, because they've just got one preposition where we have two. N covers a lot of uses of in and on in English, right?
Yeah, this was my question. Sorry that, you know, like I didn't think that it really got through to that lady, and then she won't be making the same mistake again. And I thought, before going into, you know, reading about all these things, I kind of thought that since we are so focused on meaning, I'm talking about what I'm working on, and you say, yeah, you're working on it. I'm just focusing on getting the message through.
Mm.
And oftentimes they'll be like, yeah, yeah, whatever, working on. Let me tell you what I'm working on.
Mm.
You see what I mean? Like, and then you said that it might be even more relevant for kids or young learners. But I think with adults too, like sometimes we are just so focused on telling something to our teacher because they're genuinely interested in us.
Mm-hmm.
Then we don't really focus on these. And I'm not sure how much it will turn into acquisition in the long run.
Right. I think it's a good point. And I think it's especially interesting when we consider that it really does not cause any difficulties for the interlocutor if someone says, I'm working in it.
You still know? Understand what I mean. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So when, like you say, when we are so focused on meaning and when there's not really a breakdown in communication, and maybe that we're dealing with a learner, I think in that case, in that little clip, we're talking about students that are around about B1 level, where probably they're going to make a lot of mistakes with these kind of dependent prepositions. It's a good point whether or not that's okay. Yeah, she's repeated it back. She's shown evidence straight after that she's noticed the correction. But you're right, there's still no guarantee that that's going to lead to acquisition. However, Long's argument is that it's not so much that the correction will result in acquisition, it's that the correction will result in the student hopefully noticing an input that it's working on in later. So they have to be further exposed to the correct form, right? Does that make sense? And then when they hear somebody else say that they're working on it, then there's part of their kind of mind that's like, ah, yeah, yeah, yeah. You know, that's noticing the fact that it's on and not in. Mm. Right? Does that make sense?
Yeah.
Yeah, I find just an example that I had yesterday. I was thinking about this while I was doing an online lesson yesterday afternoon. My student who's doing his A-levels, if the A-levels go ahead this summer, he kept saying in Monday, which is a direct translation from Polish. At first I tried to unobtrusively recast it. So on Monday you did this, right? And he said he went on to talk about what he did. And then later on he was saying in Monday. So I stopped and corrected him with a more explicit on Monday, you mean?
Yeah.
But I still heard him later on sort of keeping going with it in Monday, mm. as though it was almost fossilized there.
Yes, that's a tricky one. I don't know if you've got any success stories from this type of correction, because one I always go back to is I've got a private student I work with who does it. Well, she did, and she stopped doing it. Which this is why it's a success story, right? But when we talk about word order, for example, and position of adverbs, which was another example, I think, in the presentation, where one student said, always we do it, or always it's possible. Anyway, her thing was to, what is it again? It's things like, God, now I forget what it is because she doesn't do it anymore. I think it was something similar. It's like fronting the adverb, no? It's like saying something like, usually we do this, or always we do that. Anyway, just through constant recasting, so you always do that, maybe with a little bit of exaggeration, we got there, and at first it was this hesitant thing that she was doing where she caught herself. And sometimes I think we notice students do that, right? When they become aware of an issue, they kind of correct themselves. I think it's always a great sign of a good student is that they catch themselves once you've done it a few times. And then I think I wasn't satisfied with that until the first day she spontaneously didn't do it. And she gave a kind of, I can't remember the exact example that it was, but it was a very frequent thing. And I was like, wow, yeah, your husband always does this, right? And she was like, ah, yeah, I did it. And she's like, I didn't even think about it. And I was like, bingo. And I, that's the greatly satisfying thing when you have worked on something, which again, it's not a hugely difficult. I mean, it's not a hugely important thing in the sense that it doesn't really cause breakdowns of communication. It's more about somebody who's getting more advanced and you, they want to be more accurate. So we get these little breakthroughs. And I think that's just a good example of when I think things like raycasts, you can find evidence. Has anyone got any other examples like that? I mean, prepositions are difficult, Stephen. You mentioned this. Prepositions, yeah.
Something, a phonological one I have a student in Poland, the W that we have, they say is V. So when if I've got perhaps a visual, what I associate as somebody who's particularly visually oriented, I know about learning styles as being nonsense and whatnot, but I still think of it because that's what I was taught in CELTA, that these particular learning styles are legitimate. It seems to me when some of my learners, when they see the words in their mind as they're speaking it, I often hear them say the V sound when they're saying right, as in to write, or wrong. They'll say wrong or right. And I'll point it out. And I have noticed one of my students, he will say it and then he will correct himself. And after he first corrected himself, he stopped using the right example. And yesterday I caught him doing it again, and then it was just a case of I can't remember what they call it in the book, it was a raised eyebrow or a smile from me gets him to notice that he's made the mistake again, and then he corrects himself. But I have quite a few students who do that.
Here it tends to be W often gets pronounced as G, because there's no W in Spanish. So even like, I think words like whiskey in the classic Spanish spelling get written as G-U-I-S-K-I. So it's like whisky. And of course, not everyone struggles with this, but I still, you know, often you get students pronouncing wood as good. So yeah, I think whatever little things you can do to draw their attention to that can have a big impact. You know, I always just try to get them to, and I think, okay, it doesn't matter if you're a visual learner, kinesthetic, whatever it's supposed to be, but drawing attention to physical aspects of how we produce sounds, I think does have an impact. Now, I'm pretty sure I get them to think about blowing a kiss kind of thing, or like kind of wah, kind of that kind of movement. And yeah, that seems to work. I've just remembered that the thing about the adverb with my student, it was saying things like, I like very much chocolate. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that kind of structure. Where a lot of Latin languages, a lot of languages, of course, they're a lot more flexible than English, right? Where you can put the adverb in a lot of different places. But in that case, no, that was the example. It was to say, it was to state a preference with like or love or hate or whatever. And then the adverb.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
No, go on.
I'm sorry. I've got a student who cannot, I've heard her change it once only. In the 6 months that I've been teaching her, she says, it's mean, instead of it means.
Ah, yeah.
She doesn't do it with anything. Oh, she does it with it's depend as well.
Of something.
Yeah, of as well. Yeah, they do. Yeah, the natural translation from in Polish is of, as Anita says. I've managed to help them change of to on, but I cannot get this one student to change it's mean at all. No matter what I do, she says it's mean all the time.
Okay.
And I don't know how to help her past that. Beyond what I'm doing to
them. Well, maybe she's just not developmentally ready. No, as we're going to see, that this third person S, right, which is, she's putting it in the wrong place, isn't she? She's sticking it on the it and not on the mean. It's obviously something that comes late. It's not salient. It doesn't probably cause a communication breakdown in most cases. And it's just one of these things where Maybe it doesn't matter at the moment, and maybe it's just the exposure. You know, we've got this concept of fossilization, right? That Long has kind of challenged that concept in a couple of articles, and he thinks that it is possible, you know, to get people beyond that, these things that stick. But I think there are going to be some things that stick a lot longer than others. I know in my Spanish, in my Catalan, there are things that I notice them. It's just, they've come out of my mouth before it's just too late, you know. But I think that self-correction thing is a really good sign. Once people start noticing their own errors, and I think a lot of this comes down to learner aptitude, language awareness, and there's just some people that seem to be more able than others to do it. But once you notice people start catching their own errors, even if they're a bit delayed, and it may take a raised eyebrow, as you say, Stephen, to get the message across, then I think we're on to a winner, and it's going to be just a matter of time before they're doing it right. Yeah, my big thing with Spanish was, it's the reverse problem that a lot of Spanish speakers have with the word people. Because in Spanish, gente is a uncountable noun. So you use it like you would say, it's like saying the people is. So when they speak English, people is, or people does something. And it's the reverse for English speakers trying to learn Spanish, I think, is that I tend to say like la gente son, which is like the people are, but in Spanish it sounds really wrong. It took me bloody ages. So these are just things I think, obviously, the claim about developmental sequences is that they are not dependent on L1, but obviously L1 does influence things. But as that Ortega article points out, it influences things less than probably we imagine. And she gives a few examples of where people from quite different language backgrounds will go through the same stage in English, whether or not, well, for example, with question formation, whether or not they invert word order in questions in their own language or not. They tend not to do it in English at first, right? Which is quite an interesting finding that, and it points to, I think, probably there's probably evidence of some kind of module of the mind that learns languages in a very similar way, no matter where we're from. John, I'm interested to know about Chinese students and their attitude towards correction. I know that we talked a little bit about in one forum discussion about collaborative learning, and you know, you've got your learners quite well trained to take, you know, to participate.
I don't think it's me. I think it's more what they're used to, but sure, yeah.
Right. How do they, now, without being racist and like lumping everyone together, sure. How do Chinese learners in general respond to explicit correction or correction on the spot? Is it something you have to be careful with? I know Japanese learners sometimes feel a little bit exposed when they're corrected on the spot. And I had one student... go on, yeah.
No, I'd say definitely you've got to be careful a little bit, but equally they also demand the explicit correction.
Okay.
Like I work in an office where most of the time like some of my colleagues, like even today, they're like, John, you're not correcting my English enough. It's like, well, I'm not your English teacher, I'm your colleague. Like, I'm not here to correct your English. They're like, no. When I write bad emails, you've got to tell me. And it's like, oh, okay. But like today, it's often things like countable and uncountable nouns. You need to talk to some other staffs about that. Stuff like that, but it makes no difference to communication. I've got to the stage where it doesn't really bother me, to be quite honest, and we just get on with our work. So it's like in group situations, you have to be careful with correction, with the whole kind of face stuff and losing face in front of the rest of the group.
Right.
But equally, they really want explicit correction. They just would prefer it delivered like one-on-one or in a anonymous way. I was just thinking about all the things about like all the stuff that doesn't cause communications with breakdown. And I mean, I don't want to veer off topic, but with all the like English as a lingua franca stuff, you know, it sort of raises questions like should, you know, is it, are these areas we really need to focus on? I mean, obviously it depends on context and other things, but
maybe, I don't know. Anita, as a non-native speaker of English, what's your feeling about this? Because obviously you teach English, your English is super accurate, super fluent.
Yes, but then I do make mistakes, and I don't know. I when the whole like EFL topic came up a couple of years ago.
The ELF, you mean the
ELF? Sorry.
Yeah.
The ELF. It for me as a learner back then, it was a relief to hear about this and realize that like things that won't hinder communication might be just okay to say, yeah, you got the message through, and about accuracy. And then I went to a workshop a couple of years ago, and it was very interesting. We had like a couple of sentences on the board. One example was different from, different than, and different to. Like these things are different from each other, different than each other, different to each other. And then we had to discuss in pairs which one we think were correct. And then it turned out that in most situations, all of them are, or most of them are. And then it's hard to say like which one is correct and who's to say what is correct.
Sure.
More, so.
Well, it's very cultural, isn't it? I mean, I think US English is more tends towards different than, which sounds wrong to me. But they can't be wrong because they're native English speakers, you know what I mean? So it's just one of these things. It's, yeah, you're right. These things are not hugely important.
But then on the other hand, for me as a non-native speaker, I also find it a bit difficult now because, okay, if I say different from, and then I correct students for not saying different then. Like, you know, now I find it a bit hard to tell, like, is it wrong? Is it just something I use? Or is everything acceptable? And yeah, I don't know if you see what I mean. Like,
yeah, no, I see what you mean.
Like what to address, is that actually wrong?
Sure.
I guess it might be the same for native speakers too now, but.
What do you guys think? If a student says different than, would you intervene? What would you do?
I think if that's a student's biggest problem, like we're already on to a winner.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. I agree. I quite like highlighting when they've used them, you know, when they've said in the American form, that's how the Americans say, I say different from, you know, sometimes it's an interesting point of comparison. And I think it helps students to see that English is not one big standardized monolith of a language. In fact, it's a lot less standardized than a lot of other languages. It doesn't have a governing body that regulates it like Spanish and French do, for example. And I don't know about Polish or Chinese, but you've got the Royal Academies of the language that say you can say this, but you can't say that. Obviously, people speak it how they speak it. But when it comes to a kind of police saying how it should be spoken, English, I think, is a little bit more flexible than some other languages.
I've often been in situations when I said, I don't think this is right, and then someone quoted a song or a poem or just put a website up, and now, see, this is used here.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. Yeah, I don't got it. Stuff like that. But then, of course,
I was just going to say, I've done the same, Anita. I've been unsure of a use, and then I've gone after the lesson to check on the Brigham Young, Corpora website to check and found out. I was saying in that lesson that I don't think it's right, but there are several examples here because I'm not used to using it in that particular way.
Yeah.
Yeah, it might happen to everyone. I was training on a CELTA course and we were doing feedback to each other on the board. And then someone wrote, a native speaker wrote, you should have done more error correction.
Right, right.
And then I said, I don't think that's right. And then he got into a fight with me, like, don't you tell me how I use my native language.
Yeah, yeah.
So.
But he was wrong. But it's a very common error. It's an error.
Yeah.
Isn't it? But it's transferring from spoken English, because that's what it sounds like. And there are tons like that.
Reinforced on social media as well.
Yeah.
Yeah, probably. And shop signs and other things when you see apostrophe S used wrongly and all that kind of thing. But yeah, I mean, I really appreciate what the thinking behind ELF. And I think that it helps in some cases when you do have students who only need to communicate with other non-native speakers, then I think it helps to choose what to focus on, right? So maybe you're going to spend a lot less time on phrasal verbs with people who need to use ELF predominantly than you might with students who are going to live and work in an English-speaking country. But you may have students who are not going to speak to a lot of native speakers, but they want to watch series, listen to songs, you know, that use a lot of phrasal verbs. You know what I mean? It's that kind of thing that you go, well, I tend to think, I think there is no one standard of English, but there are a variety of standards, right? And I think it's good for students to be exposed and to different ones, and they can decide for themselves. That's my take on it.
Like, I've found myself at a disadvantage here. Like, I've sat in meetings where I've been the only native speaker and we're communicating in English for my benefit, basically, because, you know, I'm not as proficient in Chinese as they are in English. Mm-hmm. And they're all understanding each other perfectly. And I'm thinking, all right, well, they're talking my language and they're all understanding each other, but actually I'm really struggling to follow this. And, you know, it's actually like kind of my issue, really, not their issue whatsoever.
You need to learn ELF.
Yes. Yeah, well, that's what some people say, but I think it's more, I just need to learn more Chinese so I understand the particularities of what they're saying when they're trying to communicate in English.
And what is it? Is it pronunciation things? Is it syntax or is it a variety?
It's a variety. It's probably most often it's pronunciation. But there's a few times with like syntax where I normally get there in the end, but it's, you know, takes me like a few more seconds to process.
There's another thing that happens where I think if you've lived in a non-English speaking country for a sufficient amount of time, working with people learning English, you start to replicate the English they speak. Right? You're nodding.
Yeah.
It's a bizarre phenomenon.
Absolutely agree with that. I caught myself doing it last year. I said, why am I suddenly saying this particular way? I've never said it before. And it like creeped in without me realizing, you know, I was doing it.
I have an excuse. I use no a lot as a question tag, which is very Spanish, but we do it in Glasgow as well. So I defend that because people, but they say more like, no. You'll be hungry, no. But not so much like, no. But there are certain things I do, and like saying better as a kind of single word response to someone improving is a very Spanish thing. People say, ah, mejor. And that isn't right.
I did last year the thing that was creeping into me, and I didn't realize I was doing it, was I reminded myself instead of I remember. Because the Polish year, and I noticed my daughter doing it as well, now that she's fluent in Polish, she will use that form exclusively. And now I remind her that it's remember rather than remind myself. It's very rare remind myself usage. Przypominam sobie, it would be the Polish. But I found everybody using it here in English.
Yeah.
And I would catch myself saying, I reminded myself. What am I talking about? I remembered.
It's funny how that's a more complex way of saying it. You know, there's a tendency, I tend to pick up things that are simpler ways of saying it. So in English, like say you go into a restaurant and you want to explain how many people there are. I mean, technically you need to say there are three of us. But Spanish is we are three. And that is really easy to pick up because it's just so much simpler, more direct. And I correct students when they say, yes, we were three and we went to, no, I'm sorry, you can't say that. Well, how do I say it? There were three of us. Nah, get out of here. They just can't believe it's just so complicated. And they've got a point, you know. And maybe in this kind of multilingual age, we will just adopt the line of least resistance. And I mean, there are certain linguists who think that, you know, is it Zipf's law where you end up with the simplest structure? So in Spanish, in Spain, for example, Andalusia has the least complex pronunciation because they dropped the ends of words, right? But it doesn't stop them being understood. But apparently that's the tendency across all of Spain, is that that started to happen. So another thing is like the past participle in Spanish is like with ADO. So he comprado is I have bought. But the D in Andalusia traditionally was dropped. So instead of saying comprado, they say comprao. And that is happening across Spain. And I've got students of a certain age who'll tell me that when they were younger, they said they pronounced the D, or at least a kind of the, and now they don't. Some people think it's a sign of bad education, and they think it's, you know, it sounds like you're a illiterate or whatever, but it's happening, and it's just the kind of natural tendency to simplify. So maybe that's something in that as well. But just to pick up what you mentioned, your daughter, focus on form happens a lot with kids, and recasts, we do it all the time. And it's just interesting to see that process taking place. And with them, it's all implicit, right? They just seem to pick up these regularities.
She had difficulty up until last year. She had difficulty with countable and uncountable nouns. She was saying much and many in the wrong way. Mm. And she's 8 years old now, so I think she's worked it out after I've repeatedly reminded her that it's the wrong way. But I don't think she makes that mistake anymore, but she was making it all the time last year.
Right. But she got two languages at home, is she?
Yeah, she does. She, my in-laws don't speak any English.
Okay.
So, which is where I've learned whatever Polish I can speak, because yeah. I've had to communicate about my daughter and son. But she didn't speak any Polish at all before we came here in 2017. Mm-hmm. So she's been thrown in the deep end, mm-hmm. and now she doesn't have any difficulty at all. Friends say that she's lost her English accent as well when she speaks Polish, which I'm pleased about.
Okay, so she was speaking Polish with an English accent?
She was right at the beginning, but she's lost that now that she's been here 2 or 3 years.
I have this battle with my daughter. She's only four. She just started to speak English now, really. It's started to come out a lot more. But she still says English. And I'll say, did you do an English today at school? No, no English. And I was like, it's English. And when we play Snap, she says, Snap. It drives me crazy. But yeah, all these things come out in the wash, I think. But it's really fascinating to see what happens. And I think this is the point that Long makes about recasts. Sorry, we're running out of time already. We'll get onto this now. Let's get onto it. But the developmental sequences, I believe teachers need to know about these sequences to make better informed decisions about what we correct and when we correct it. Long thinks that we just naturally know. And he always gives the example of kids, that parents kind of naturally select when to correct their kids or when to kind of echo back the correct form without really thinking about it and without being trained teachers. And I kind of see his point. But I think the problem is with teacher training and with the materials we've been exposed to since we started teaching is I think we get the impression that grammar is learnt in a certain order from course books. And people get, without knowing better, get frustrated by the fact that students don't learn it in that sequence that has been presented to them. To an extreme point, extreme, I think, level that I work with a teacher who wouldn't let her poor students get beyond the beginner's course book until she was satisfied that they'd really mastered the verb to be. And it's an extreme case, right? It's an extreme case. And she was a pretty eccentric person. But I see that kind of, God, I can't believe they don't have the second conditional yet. They seem to know what it is, but they just can't, give them a break. I think I can see Mike's point that if we let go of all that, then intuitively we could be helping our students a lot and we'd be reacting to them in a way that helped them in the moment that they need it. But I think the way we're programmed sometimes makes us insist on things that are a waste of time to insist on. So that's why I believe that I think maybe just to counter the early training that we've had in some cases at least, it's worth being aware of these sequences. And we don't know everything about them. It's not a magic, pill that's going to solve all our problems, because we simply don't know everything there is to know about these sequences. Yeah. But anyway, we've rattled on. Sorry, go on, Anita.
Sorry, no, I just wanted to add, I think it's what you said about kids and adults. I think it's obviously going to be harder with adults because an adult is, so they want to express a more complex idea probably. And there are a couple of things I can correct here. Like there can be a third person S or a third conditional, but in a kid's case, probably the message is simple too. So then the language for it is probably going to be simpler too. So there aren't so many pedagogical decisions that we have to make about what to correct or what not. Right. If the sentence is, give me my favorite toy.
Yeah.
As opposed to, I would be very angry if you wouldn't give me, you see what I mean? If you didn't give me my favorite toy.
Yeah, exactly.
Do you see what I mean? I think.
If you would have given me my favorite toy.
Because I experienced this in my Spanish too, that because my Spanish is around a B1, but I think I'm intelligent and can be witty and funny, but I'm just not at the level yet. And I want to express myself in social situations as I would in my native language. And I get frustrated about not being able to make jokes or say something that is like a pun with double meaning. So it's just more complex what's in my head and what I want to express than what a kid wants to do.
Totally. There's an expression in Spanish that if a room is empty or if a bar is almost completely empty, they say there's four cats here, or there's only four cats. If someone says there's only four cats here, that means there's nobody here. Right, it's a kind of idiom. And I was asked to give a talk in Spanish as a kind of philosophy thing in a bookshop, and the girl told me I think there'll just be four cats there, right, meaning no one's going to come because But when I got there, the place was full. And so I made this joke in Spanish. And I thought it was really funny. I said, oh, they told me there'd just be four cats here, but I can't see any cats at all. And nobody laughed. Everyone just stared at me. And I said to my wife later on, and she just said, Neil, that just wasn't very funny. And I was like, damn. Because I think it is a sign, if you can crack a joke, a spontaneous thing in a, but at the end of the day, there's no accounting for senses of humor, right? I just wanted to it's going to be very brief now, just to review this Ortega, just to make sure that we're all kind of clear about it. I know I made it the required reading, but I just wondered if there were any questions. I'll just share my screen, I think, so we can look at the relevant bits, which I think are these tables that Ortega presents of sequences. because there are a couple of little things with them. Let's see, where's my, there it is. Have you had a chance to look at it? Yeah, the Ortega paper, here it is.
Oh, I have a question, and it might be a slight one.
Go on.
So how is it possible that, so the regular past comes before the regular past in this sequence, then how is it possible that we make overgeneralizations and fossilized mistakes with the irregular past? So,
go on. I don't quite follow you.
So, for example, I'll find the example here.
Here it is. Here, yeah, table 6.1.
Yes, but then it says, then we do make mistakes like I fold or I cummed or I goad.
Yes.
But supposedly the irregular past should come before the regular one.
Right. I think very often what happens is that the regular past is taught first, or because we think it's, I don't know, I think it's often presented in course books. No, it's not. What happens in course books, it tends to be verb to be, regular, which is irregular.
Yeah.
Yeah. But if I remember working with reward, and then they taught to be, and then they did just regular, and then they went on to irregular. I just think maybe that we give the impression, or students get the idea, that adding ed is how we form the past, and they just overextend that. But I think it's the idea of what we acquire first, rather than what we're kind of trying out. Do you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
So it's just a case of knowing. If you've not been exposed enough to the regular past forms, you're not going to pick them up, and maybe you just add an ed on the verb. You've learnt the verb, right? So what you're really learning is the morpheme. In the case of irregular, it's a new morpheme, or it's a free morpheme kind of thing. But where in the case of regular, it's a bound morpheme. It's an ending that we stick on it, right? So I think the trick here is to think about, given enough exposure, what will they pick up first? And what will they be able to use better first? And according to all these studies, it's irregular. Yeah? Does that make sense? I know what you mean. But I think this is the kind of idea of fossilization is, or about, what did you call it again? Overgeneralization?
Yeah.
That can happen with a lot of forms. But it's this, because it's this kind of, even though we've got these sequences, we still can't think of them as completely linear, because we've got this thing that they talk about as being a kind of U-shaped progression, that you'll make a bit of progress and then you'll kind of go back. This happened with me a lot with subjunctive in Spanish. I didn't use it at all, and then I overused the hell out of it, and only now am I starting to get it right, I think. Most times. But I think in a lot of these studies, they count, I think, getting it right in about 80% of circumstances when it's appropriate is when you're said to have acquired it. And according to that measure, people acquire the irregular before the regular. But it makes a lot of sense when you think about saliency, right? Because it's simply a lot less salient, this ED, and especially the way we pronounce it. And I often think, sometimes it's very difficult to know whether a student has not acquired the ED or they simply can't pronounce it. You know what I mean? Because maybe they'll write it correctly, but we can't hear it when they produce it because they're not producing it properly. But it's extremely difficult for them to hear. Yeah.
Connected to that table, I have a couple of students who really struggle with auxiliaries in the continuous. Mm-hmm. Aspect. But they don't seem to me to have a difficulty with the regular past.
Okay. That's interesting.
I was just wondering whether it was it's idiosyncratic of them. I presume it is because of all the tests that they've done. I just noticed that a lot with my students. Possibly because Polish doesn't have an auxiliary system, maybe.
It may be. And I don't think we can ignore L1. We can't ignore L1 interference in these sequences. It's got to have an impact in some cases. I'm sure it does. but yeah. Okay, so there may be, like, we may take exception to some of these from our own observation of certain groups of students, but this is looking across the board. And maybe that, you know, looking in that very general way might take away some of the nuances of people with particular L1 backgrounds, right? Okay, but I think in general, this first lot, for me, there's not too much that's controversial about it, especially when we look at these last things of third person S. And we know that from bitter experience that gets taught early and gets learned very late. I think it's a very good example of that. ING forms, looking at the other extreme, I think we hear them getting used a lot at the beginning because it's an easy one to hear and to add. And I don't know about the students you teach, but Spanish speakers tend to put ING in a lot of things, the kind of fashionable thing. Footing is what they call jogging, for example. Right? So anyway, that's the morphemes. Let me just skip forward to these ones. That's about Spanish. Let's leave that one out. Negation. Again, I think something that we hit students over the head with, how to negate properly at the beginning, and we get so frustrated when they don't do it. And maybe we'll go a little bit easier on them. I think it's just. I think teachers need to know this, and to know when to, you know, get at students to help them improve, and when to maybe think, okay, let's let it go just now, right? But that's one. And I think that last one's a really good example as well, because even the correct one, they've got the nobody wrong instead of anybody. And I think that must be one of the last things that anyone ever masters in English, is this distinction between no and some and any. It's really hard to get across.
Especially when you don't have a prohibition on double negatives and so on in the L1.
Yes, right.
Because I see all of these in my students, except for number two. And the reason I don't see number two is because instead of don't saw him, my students tend to say I didn't saw him as a combination.
Yeah, but I think that would count. No, I wouldn't. No, because it says with don't. Yeah, we did look at these studies in detail to see if they include things like that as well. Because I think these are kind of like reduced patterns that are being presented here. But yeah, but in general, no, we recognise a lot of these sequences, and we recognise students' difficulties with forming negatives in English with these auxiliary verbs. Okay. Just stop me if I'm going too fast. I just want to, like, very quickly review these things and make sure we were kind of clear. German. Let's skip that one. Now, this one I think is really interesting, the relative clauses. Oh, no, that was right. First of all, questions. Okay, questions. I think this, for me, is kind of borne out by experience as well. The rising intonation being the first way. And let's face it, we do it a lot ourselves. I mean, we often ask questions in that kind of way, I think. Until finally we get these more complex forms, right? With WH questions and yes, no. And some people never get to this last stage. And it's really hard. In fact, I hear native speakers a lot using the questions in embedded clauses and not doing the correct word order. Sure.
Yeah.
So how we expect our learners to master that until very late, I don't know.
In Chinese, question words are often at the end of sentences. So often I see that in speech as well. Like there's markers that are often added at the end. They're kind of flexible in places, but often right at the end. So often, like, the house is where?
Yeah, that doesn't sound completely unnatural to me. I can...
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, depending on the context, I think, yeah, you're right, could be totally natural. But
you said what now? You know, yeah. You can. So yeah, it's interesting. Spoken grammar, as we know, is a lot more flexible than the kind of canonical grammar or written grammar, right? So yeah, it's interesting to know. Okay, so nothing too controversial there. It was the, sorry, I'm going on a little bit. I'll try to stop, but leave if you, honestly, just if you don't have time. The relative clauses I find really interesting. I just want to comment on this and then the past perfect stuff, because it seems to be, this is across different languages, that they don't all have these various forms of relative clause, but they're all acquired in about the same order. And that if you acquire one of the later ones, you get the earlier ones for free. But I don't know if you picked up on that. Does that make sense? Let's see, where does it say that?
They were saying it follows a specific order, doesn't it? With like a building one on top of the other.
Yeah, so this one is, each lower type is possible in a given language only if all other preceding less marked types are also possible. Right? So some languages have only the simplest type of subject relativization at the top of the hierarchy. So they mentioned Maori, for example. And at the other extreme, some languages allow the full range of six types. So Arabic and English. Many languages have five of the six.
Okay. Yeah.
What's that?
Hungarian too.
Hungarian has five of the six. So what, you don't have the genitive one, is that right? Or the object of comparison?
No, I think they have six, yeah.
You have the six. Mm. Okay, but where was it about getting it for free? That was, no, it's there somewhere if you look at it. So basically acquiring one of the more complex ones, even if you haven't like been explicitly exposed to the earlier ones, you kind of get them. Which I just think is more evidence of having a kind of module of the mind for language learning. It just seems like a very bizarre thing to happen.
It sounds like the Berlin and Kay like color studies from years ago.
What's that?
Whereby like languages that have different words for different colors, like they go in a certain order. I can't remember exactly what it was, but like some obscure indigenous languages might just have words for like light and dark, mm-hmm. but languages that have more, I'm explaining this really badly. Like it goes in a set pattern, like yeah. The more color distinctions that there are in languages.
Okay.
I think it's been pretty controversial and lots of people have been taking it in different ways, but I remember when I did my undergrad degree and that's what was being talked about. Mm-hmm. And I'll have to dig it up.
No, that's interesting. That's really interesting. But yeah, I just thought that was a slightly different example than the other ones. And obviously Ortega explains it a lot better than I do. The only other thing I wanted to highlight that I thought was really interesting to me is what she talks about the past perfect, what she describes in terms of past perfect. So let's see if I can just find that a little bit in the text. Oh, no, I can't do a search. Where is it? Okay, let me not waste your time. The idea was that I think past perfect is another example, no, of something that we tend to teach with other past tenses. Okay, what do? We say they've been taught the past simple, they've been taught the past continuous. Now let's do narrative tenses as a set, no, and let's do anecdotes or something like that, right? And it's in a lot of course books. And it's something that really surprised me earlier on when I considered, I just found it really hard to get students to use past perfect, even when in Spanish, for example, they have a past perfect and it's got almost the same form and function as it has in English, almost identical. And I just couldn't understand why they weren't producing it. And it turns out, according to the studies, and it's in this article somewhere, that until they get until they've mastered the ED of past simple, and I think again the threshold was something like in 80% of cases they get it right, then they're not going to get past perfect. And secondly, of course, that past perfect is required, because as we know, it's quite flexible, past perfect, right? It's only needed when we have to clarify a sequence.
Why is that, Neil? Because you, with the past simple, you don't have the same form as the past perfect. You're like the third form of the past participle with the had, but you don't have the ed or...
I don't know. I really don't know, but it was just a really interesting observation. Well, obviously, more than an observation, it's been studied. And it explained a lot to me, really, and it made me realize that, okay, I've been teaching past perfect to students who just weren't quite ready yet. It's just an interesting phenomenon based on the fact that it's right there in their L1, and it's used for the same purpose. And it just wasn't happening. It wasn't being produced. There's another example of when it's notoriously difficult to force production of certain structures in tasks. And Ellis talks about this in his focused tasks. You can create especially productive tasks which you want to facilitate the production of certain structures, but it's very difficult to force the production of that structure anyway. So I often thought, they're just avoiding it because the task's too open.
It's one of the least...
I found it. It's page 98.
Ah, thank you.
Towards the end of the paragraph.
Yes, in 98. Oh, it's talking about fossilization.
And then there is an example. If you roll down a bit, even more, roll down. And then there is the example, John entered college in 1980.
Okay, he had graduated. Okay, that's it, yeah.
And then the first point.
Yes, that's it. That's it, I was right. Learners had first to reach stable accuracy of about 80% of the appliance of ED, and then they had to begin creating contexts involving reverse order reports. That semantically, yes, it's got to be called for by the context, right? Otherwise, we don't use past perfect. And regardless of this is the kind of thing that hits you. Regardless of instruction, they began using the new form when they had met these prerequisites, which just underlines this whole thing about learners not learning what teachers teach. So anyway, this is where I disagree with Mike. I think having this knowledge for what it is, if it can be presented to teachers in a reasonably straightforward way, I think can only help us make informed decisions about when we focus on form and when we don't bother. John, as a teacher trainer, would you agree with that? Or what do you think? Is this something you would present to, maybe not this article, but in some format, would you present these sequences to your trainees?
I can't say it's anything I've done explicitly, but I think it's something like I definitely think about. I mean, we try to encourage them not to really do that many traditional grammar lessons in the kind of like, oh, we're going to do a lesson on the second conditional. We generally try and get them to focus on tasks and things that they want to do and like think about what language is going to come out from that. And it tends to be more functional language than specific, like what textbooks describe as grammar points. Mainly because in most of the teachers, that's what they're used to. And this gives them something different. But I think it's just, I think presenting is one thing, but it's also like we've had this conversation because we've all had experience. And I think it's very different, like saying, well, yeah, you know, you've got to think about this developmental sequence, but until you've actually seen a wide range of students for yourself, I don't think you quite internalize that.
Right. And often with beginning teachers, it's really hard to get them to correct anything, right?
Yeah, totally. I mean,
they just don't notice it, or they don't react quick enough, or...
Yeah.
Good point, yeah.
Exactly. Yeah, I feel like we're talking about it from a language acquisition perspective, but it's also probably similar in like, I don't know what's called a teaching skills acquisition. Mm. Like maybe we need to be more reactive and focus on teaching form rather than like presenting them, you need to do this, 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 and this. It's more like see what they're instinctively doing and work with that.
Ooh, very good. I like that.
But, you know, then you've got a syllabus from exam boards, like Trinity is really flexible and, you know, working with Trinity is generally really positive, but like I've still got to pay my bills and all the rest of it, I suppose.
Well, if you want to pay your bills, I think a book on focus on teaching form, I think you've got yourself a little, a little catchy focus point there. Quite like that. Teacher training reactively. I mean, I think that's, I mean, yeah, that's very, very, very true. I personally think that in courses I've trained on, when they're having to use published materials that present grammar in a certain way, I would be wanting to talk about this. If the purpose of teacher training is to help students, to some extent at least, use published materials, because that's what happens in a lot of places that they're going to go and work,
yep.
Then maybe we're not going to expect big results at the beginning, but I think I would want to start highlighting some of this stuff. Look, okay, it says we're going to do a third person this here. Okay, let's not expect, you know, I think it's just about managing teacher expectations. And I think it's fantastic if you're training teachers in a more communicative way, but if they're being trained in this more kind of how to apply a structural syllabus, I'd want them to be, I guess, just being a little bit, I guess, just putting that in context a little bit and thinking about what we can realistically expect students to produce. Because if we don't do that, then they're going to find that out through bitter experience anyway, I think. At least that was my case.
The struggle we really have is that, you know, it's a kind of strange context in that we're all of our teachers are in-service teachers taking a pre-service course.
Yeah.
And, you know, they can apply bits of what they learn in their day-to-day teaching practice, but actually, you know, the company I work for is extremely restrictive for them, and they're, you know, given prescribed materials, they don't have much flexibility or creativity, mm-hmm. and they come to Cert TESOL and the DIP TESOL courses and get to be creative and try stuff out and do different things, but they're kind of like, well, John, we can't really do any, it's fun and we're learning stuff and this is great, but we can't really do this in our day-to-day jobs. So like for our point of view as trainers, it can be pretty disheartening. Like at the end of courses saying, oh yeah, it was great, but actually we can't really do much with this. And it just gives them a pay rise for having more qualifications.
Right, right.
Yeah. Sorry, I've just moaned at you, but.
No. everything okay with EF where you are, by the way, because we just lost contract with the materials writing stuff, they've just chopped that off because they're apparently suffering.
Yeah, financially. EF is really suffering financially, particularly adult schools. They've done massive consolidations of adult schools. Basically, the kids and teen schools are propping up the entire business, I think it's fair to say.
Wow. Yeah.
Like the kids and teen schools are growing at a insane rate. I mean, here in Shenzhen, they've got 20-odd schools of a few thousand students.
Wow, that's crazy.
But, you know, as a training team, we're kind of a bit separate to it. We don't work for either the kids' schools or the adult schools. And, we kind of get referred to as Switzerland. like we're kind of stuck in the middle and neutral on everything and just do some training.
Which is interesting because that's where the EF headquarters is.
Headquarters is, yeah.
I wonder why. Anyway, they owe us money, so if you, I'm only joking.
Okay, I'll take it up with upstairs.
Yeah, please do. No, I'm just joking. We're in a bit of a panic right now, but that's the other thing. So yeah, okay, we started this conversation on a depressing note and we're ending it on a... We started with a health crisis and now we're ending on the economic side of it. Okay, I'm sorry, we've gone on too long, mainly because we started with this navel-gazing about coronavirus, but I hope that's been okay. I hope we've managed to like further a little bit our understanding of what Focus on Farm is about and, you know, what it means, what kind of decision-making we have to be doing. And any last comments or questions, or are you all good? No?
I think I'm all good.
Thanks a lot. Been really good talking to you again. Yeah. And
thank you.
That's it. Anita, you're going to spend a long time on Zoom today, aren't you? You're
doing this webinar. Oh, by the way, if you guys are interested, we're doing a webinar this afternoon on teaching online. I can send you the link. Yeah.
Is it going to be recorded? Just because it's already almost 10:30 at night.
It is. So, okay. Yeah, it is.
But I'd be really keen because, like, honestly, running input sessions online, you know, any new tips and tricks would be much appreciated.
What was it? We're recording it. We're going to see how good it is before we decide whether or not to share it.
Okay,
exactly.
Sure.
Yes. Yeah.
No, I'm sure it's going
it's
to be
very bad than we won't share it. But
I'm sure it's not going to be very bad. I'm just sorry I can't join you either. So I look forward to seeing the recording as well. But yeah, best of luck with that, Anita.
Thanks.
Yeah, I've got to. Since yesterday, since I saw the tweet, I've had it booked. Unless I get called away through what sounds like children trying to hurt each other, try and be there.
Okay, yeah. Good.
I better go and deal with that as well. Just now. Okay, guys, keep your chins up, etc. We'll get through this.
You too.
Thanks a lot. Take care, everyone.
Cheers. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye.
Bye-bye. Bye.